From coast to coast to coast, the newsmakers talk here.
I like that music.
This is the Evan Solomon Show.
All right, Canada, welcome to same old, deja vu all over again. Is that what happened last night? When I got home at 3:30 a.m. from the CTV national coverage, and we all looked at each other and was like, is that what happened last night? Did we all just basically go around a big merry-go-around the mulberry bush to end up? Yeah, basically it's the same thing. We did a $600 million election and we got literally the same result. The message Canadians sent to politicians is, no one's getting the cookie. Stop looking for rewards. You work for us. We don't work for you. So here's what we're going to do. You guys are going to ask us what we want. We want you guys to get back exactly what we told you 2 years ago. This is not a time to change. And get back to work. Mr. Trudeau, you're not getting rewarded. Sorry, pal. No cookie for you. We gave you the new car in 2019 and we told you you needed a chaperone. Guess what? You still need a chaperone. Mr. O'Toole, I know that you're trying to rebrand the car, that you bought a Chevy and now you're trying to make it look like a Tesla. It's a Chevy. Drive the Chevy. It's not a Tesla. We see the smoke coming out the back. That's what you've got. Nice try. It's not Brian Mulroney's party. And we'll get to the concert. Mr. Jagmeet Singh, I know you're rocking on TikTok. I know you think that you're cool. I know that skateboarding is a very... But you don't get much either. Because you skateboard, we'll give you a couple seats. Because skateboarding, okay. And the whole TikTok thing. But nothing really. Oh, Bloc Québécois. That's all you get. Nothing. I know you made a big deal about the English language debate. I know you wanted 40 seats. No. Stop talking about... Just get to work. Canadians are tired. We've been through 18 months of a pandemic. We are not here to give Christmas presents to politicians in September. Get to work. You know, it's kind of like your kids come up to you and they're like, hey, Dad, you know, I know you just bought me that pair of sneakers 2 weeks ago, but can I have another? No. But I really like, no. But I've been so good to these last sneakers. Can I get another pair of sneakers? No. Get to work. You know what you should focus on, kids? Your schoolwork. Get some marks and then call me. Finish the pandemic, then we'll talk. Right? You know what? You know when you reward? When you finish with good marks. But don't come before the big test. Like, you want to have an election about a COVID recovery? Try this. Recover. How about that? Sounds crazy, right? You want to be rewarded for recovering from COVID? Try beating COVID first. So nobody gets anything. The Liberals basically stay status quo. They're leading, and by the way, because there's mail-in ballots and they're all being counted today, we might not know, but leading an elected, they may get 158, so they may go up a couple seats. The Conservatives, leading an elected, 119. Bloc, leading elected, you know, they may get plus two. We don't know. The NDP may get plus one. My God. I mean, talk about, but here's the thing. Small results, big consequences. That is the story of this election. Small results will lead to big consequences. Let's start lower on the tree and go to the top of it. The Green Party. Annamie Paul, who made history, first black female Jewish leader. Like a lot of glass ceilings broken. Takes over the Green Party, doesn't really leave her riding, knows if she doesn't win Toronto Centre, she is toast, and she doesn't crack the top three there. Her party's in disarray. She loses her seat for the third time. Her political career has been short, nasty, and brutish. And it's sad because she's a brilliant woman. But politics, as Jean Chrétien has famously said, is about one thing, winning. I'll tell you a story. I remember when Stéphane Dion, remember him? He was once the leader of the Liberal Party for about the period of a haiku. Anyway, when Stéphane Dion won the leadership race, I was watching Jean Chrétien sit down for an interview, and a young journalist asked him, "Mr. Chrétien, what's the difference between you and Paul Martin?" Remember Paul Martin? And because they were talking about the legacy of these two prime ministers, and how would you compare your legacy to Paul Martin's legacy? And Chrétien had this baffled look. He actually looked off camera to one of his assistants, and he looked back at the journalist without, and he goes, "I won." Like, here's the difference. I won three elections. He won one minority. I won majorities. Like, this is politics. It's about winning. So people ask, okay, what are the consequences? Anna Mee Paul, she can't hold on to power. The Green Party vote collapsed. The PPC, spoilers for the Conservatives, and we'll dig into that. How did they spoil the vote? They split the vote. They are a factor. But let's be clear here. No seats. They lost. He lost in the Beauce. Maxime Bernier is not the force he thinks he is, but he's a sign of populism. He's worth watching. They lost. But they mattered. They were consequential. But without a seat, you're a movement, you're stuck in the wilderness. Now, what happens to them, I don't know. But let's be clear. No seat, no win. That's a big loss. You got problems. And once this pandemic is done, and I hope soon, they're going to have problems. But they're relevant. We'll talk about more about them. The NDP. Jagmeet Singh, let me put this into perspective, lest the NDP math confuses you. Jagmeet Singh was embraced and is beloved in that party, okay? In 2019, he lost 20 seats. Today, he may have won between 1 and 3, depending on the mail-in ballots. He'll be down 17 to 19 seats in over 2 elections, and they will declare victory. Politics is about winning. If you were cheering for a team and the head coach had inherited the team, then lost 17 or 20 more games, and then the next season they only lost 18 games, you would start thinking about a new head coach, not the NDP. They love him. They will keep him. But make no mistake, Jagmeet Singh did not meet expectations. He's the kingmaker that'll save his political career. He's got influence. Don't get me wrong. Consequence is big, but the guy's not pulling in results. Let's be honest about it. Aaron O'Toole. Was he wrong to pull the party to the center? Probably not. He put a price on carbon. He tried to move the Conservative Party more toward the center so they could win in Quebec and Ontario. That's what Andrew Scheer was criticized for not doing. So let's be clear. Aaron O'Toole was responding to what the Conservatives said went wrong with Andrew Scheer. You overperformed in the West. You underperformed in the East where there's a lot more votes. You got to reach out to Ontario and Quebec. They picked Aaron O'Toole. He did it, and it failed. And why did it fail? We got to discuss that. Why didn't he connect in Quebec? Why didn't he connect in Ontario? Why is he alienating his own base? And is his job on the line? You better believe it. The knives are out. I spoke to Jenny Byrne last night, not only with Lisa LaFlamme on the special, but on CTV's question. His job's going to be on the line, even though he won the popular vote. And finally, that gets us to Justin Trudeau. Is he weakened? Yes. His brand certainly is. In politics, though, you're not weakened if you hold on to power. And you're not weakened if you hold on to power and you know, if he ends up with 158 seats, after all the mail, he's going to win a couple seats. Still, did he live up to expectations? No. Now, remember, Stephen Harper, minority government, then he got his majority. So he had two minorities in a row. Trudeau's the flip. Majority government, minority government, minority government. So it can happen. But at the end of Stephen Harper's time, it was time for a change. And many liberals are saying, thank you, Mr. Trudeau. Is it time for change there? But for now, no. He owns the party. His stamp is on it. And a win is a win is a win. We're going to discuss a lot more, and we got a great guest later. Stay with us.
you did not vote for us, I want you to know that we will stand up for you and work for you every single day.
Making sense of the latest news, you're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
Well, we went through the 44th federal election, and the more things change, the more things stay the same. In this case, not much change, but a lot will change, and we'll get to the consequences. But the results weren't much. Same old, but a lot's going to happen. But what happened last night? Let's dig into the numbers a bit. I should say later in the program, we're going to leave the election behind, and you're going to meet, I think, a guy they'll make a movie about. His name is the Canadian Dave. He's been in Kabul, Afghanistan, saving people's lives. He brought more than 100 people to safety. When you meet this guy, we've been trying to get this guy on the show for a long time. And I thought, Samantha and I, our producer, Sam. Hannah, by the way, is on TV now, as you all know. So our new producer I want to introduce everyone to, Samantha Pope. Sam has booked Canadian Dave. And I got to tell you, stick around for this later in the program. He's at the end of our show today. We thought in the wake of all the cynicism and the exhaustion with politics, let's get someone who went, didn't talk the talk, but walked the walk, went to Kabul and went and saved lives. Former Special Forces soldier who said, I'm going in and I'm going to rescue people. I'm going to get people out of the Taliban, people I work with. And in Afghanistan, he became known as Canadian Dave. Canadian Dave was like a hero. And you're going to meet him. And I think they'll make a movie about this guy one day. And you do not, this is for all the BS we hear from politicians and the promises. This is a guy that quietly has walked the walk in a dusty, dangerous place and saved lives. Full stop, full hero. So you're going to meet Canadian Dave. And when you meet him, you're going to thank God for people like him. And then you can measure that against what you think about the politicians. So what happened last night? There was no, quote, Canadian Dave. No one jumped into the fire and pulled people out. Nothing happened. Canadians said, go back to your corners and finish your homework before you decide to ask for candy. That's basically the answer. But Frank Graves, president of Ecos Research Associates, joins me. Frank, 44th general election. We know the top line results, Frank. What happened beneath the surface? Let's start with the Conservative Party. They were neck and neck. Everyone thought, oh, he's rebranded the party. He's going to recreate Brian Mulroney's grand coalition. He's going to get votes in Quebec. He's going to get votes in Ontario. The 905 is going to crack. The 416 is going to crack around Toronto. He's going to win the Lower Mainland. And Erin O'Toole is going to take down Justin Trudeau. Wasn't even close in the end. What happened?
Well, actually, I think, Evan, although it does look like deja vu all over again. There was some really significant movements and some significant forces at work in terms of shaping the outcome of this election, which I don't think by any means have been resolved. If you recall, they weren't neck and neck at the beginning of the campaign. Mr. O'Toole, who represented himself as not, the true rural conservative that had, used the Take Back Canada slogan, which was very much in the keeping with the more populist type of Brexit and Trump slogans, presented himself as sort of a reincarnation of Bill Davis. He moved to the center, had, plausible positions on health care, climate change, was backing off on some of the social issues and so forth. And this really caught the electorate by surprise, and he was rewarded in the early stages. They had an 8-point lead. Looked like not only were they going to win government, they might even get a majority. So that seemed very, very a very sound strategy. But as the election proceeded, and remember, this is an election that most people thought, why are we having an election? We're in the middle of a pandemic, and I don't really see the obvious reasons. But doubts began to mount as people scrutinized the reformatted, rebooted Erin O'Toole 2.0 and thought, maybe there's some issues here that he's covering up, not him personally, but about his party, that we should be concerned about. And I think the two big issues, there's a number of them, but the two issues which I think ultimately cost him were the issues of guns and his positions on vaccines in general and vaccine passport in particular.
Yeah, that was, I mean, not taking a firm position on vaccines clearly was in the end definitive for him. And I think you're right about guns as I speak to Frank Grays. But Frank, what about the PPC? Like you wrote in a tweet today, I think, noting that we had every party spot on, but we were off on the PPC and the CPC, off on the People's Party. If you add their votes, it equals the sum conservative, suggests late switch. What happened? Like you were saying that the PPC were 10%, and like what happened to that PPC vote? Was it consequential? Did it undermine the CPC vote? What happened there?
It was consequential, but not nearly as consequential as it could have been. And that's why the Conservatives, you know, I think quite shrewdly trained all their fire in the finding in the closing moments of the campaign to recapturing that vote with messages that a vote for the PPC is going to be a vote for Justin Trudeau, front page ads in the and stories in the Sun. I think you will find that there's a very effective ground game where most of those voters were erstwhile Conservatives, so they would have had them in the system. They could have been text messaging. They could have been calling them and so on. And it was successful because it's curious that the poll gets everything else right but has the CPC too low by 5 points and the PPC too high by 5 points. I think they just moved those voters into their camp, which I think has important implications for the next election because it clearly, when push comes to shove, those voters are going to say, you know, we'll come back and we'll forgive you, even if your positions on things. And by the way, going back to the vaccine issue, one of the things which gave rise to the PPC and why they went from 1 point to 10 points, even 11 points at some point in our polling and others as well, was they were united with just fierce anger about the issues of vaccine passports and the supposed suspension of civil liberties and personal freedoms. This was a
group. Did that help the Liberals? Like in the end, Frank, like was concern about the PPC that they were growing, did that flip voters to the Liberals? Like was that actually something that helped them?
I don't think so. I think the sort of the revelation, and I think the reason that that Aaron O'Toole couldn't commit to a vaccine passport, which all the experts and business and everybody else has come down to a clear consensus on, as well as the public, is that a sizable portion of both his constituency and almost everybody in the PPC who he needed to form government were adamantly opposed to this. So I think he said, well, you know,
Frank, I think we lost you. Frank, if you come back, just real quick, what happens to the PPC vote now? Like, is that a splinter group that ever rejoins the Conservatives, or is this a populist movement that's here to stay?
I think they're going to be disappointed with the result. They're going to be pleased, okay, at least we prevented the most despicable outcome, which was a Justin Trudeau victory, the majority, but we really didn't, you know, get our voice, and we're now kind of submerged within this Conservative Party that increasingly looks alien to a lot of things that we believe in. So I think that's a really important question. I don't know the answer. I doubt they're going to feel very comfortable going back to this newly positioned center-moderate Conservative Party.
And real quick, what about the Green Party vote? Collapsed? Has that been absorbed by the Liberals and the NDP?
Yes, largely. And a lot of it stayed home being discouraged. And that's ironic because just to end with one sort of big picture thought, I think one of the things we might be seeing is a hollowing out of the center right and the center left. Neither party did particularly well by historical standards. And that should open up the opportunity for parties further out on both the left and the right to become parts of a more boutique type of niche parliament in the future, as we've seen happen in Europe, where the center right and center left have been really crowded out in many respects by parties on further out on the left and right. That could well be what's in store for Canada, particularly under our first-past-the-post system. But that remains to be seen. But I think the Green Party had all the conditions to do very well in this election. Unfortunately, the internal meltdown of the party cost them doing much better.
All right, well, we're going to dig into Frank Grays from Ecos Research. Frank, always good to have you on the program. Maybe the theme is the center cannot hold or everybody's moving to the political center. I don't know. Thank you, Frank. We're going to bring in Scott Reed and Jason Leader to talk about what next, what happened. I think the big question everyone wants to, what's next? And please stay with us for a Canadian hero. You don't want to miss him. I told you that the message from voters is no cookies. Get back to work. You don't get rewarded till your report card is done. You got to finish your final exams. Please reward me for the pandemic. We'll give it to you after the pandemic. Nobody got a cookie last night. Voter said, get back to your work. No one gets rewarded for a job half done. Come back when the job's done. Maybe we'll talk again. Voters were very, very practical. No one gets really punished. Now, I said the theme today, small results, but big consequences. The agenda that the Liberals and now their dance partner, the NDP, will be, I think, robust and ambitious. And I think there's going to be big consequences in the conservative movement and the green movement. So to talk about it all, the tireless, the mellifluous, the incredibly fit, the golden-throated meadowlark, Scott Reed, the CTV News political commentator, former director of communications for Paul Martin, and his mirror image, the bluebird who sings the song that is not depressing. He himself, the walking thesaurus of wisdom, the president of Enterprise Canada, conservative strategist Jason Leader, Jason and Scott, together again. This is like ABBA without a brother.
Just like ABBA. Just like ABBA. And we will speak English phonetically for the rest of the segment.
Scott's a hell of a dancer. He's a hell
when
of
you
a
guys get together, it's like people get... It's like ABBA. They're so excited because they look at you two and they say, Sweden. Okay.
He looks like the poor man's Matt Naslund or maybe Marcus Naslund.
All my references today will be about things from the past coming back because we've basically just done the same thing twice with this election, but it's going to be big consequences. Reed, you and I were on the desk late into the night last night. By the way, superb work as always. What's the takeaway? Like, what happened and what are the consequences of last night, Scott Reed?
You know, I think the big takeaway is that Justin Trudeau was told, nope, we're going to tighten up the leash a couple kinks. Even though it's more or less the same set of seat results, I think the fact that he tried for a majority, didn't achieve a majority, means that he's going to feel a bit chastened. He's going to be reluctant to call an election again and roll those dice. And I think that means that, you know, Jagmeet Singh, who, let's face it, didn't actually, you know, blow the lights out last night. Still got his pocket picked in Ontario, only picked up a seat or so. But he's going to have more leverage because he's going to be able to say to Trudeau, I know you're not eager to go into an election. And here's the list of big things that I want you to spend big money on. And I think we're going to move from talking about childcare to talking about, are we talking about childcare and pharmacare? And yeah. So I think one of the challenges for the Liberals going forward is how do they thread the needle in terms of economic management? No one wants a deficit hawk, but if you appear to be indifferent to the expenditure of enormous sums of money, I think that bears some problems down the road for the Liberals. So they're going to have challenges managing this parliament, I think.
Yeah, I would just say literally 5 minutes before you boys came on, I got a message from another Liberal inside the PMO. We're excited about a progressive agenda we're delivering on childcare, climate change, housing, lots to do. Like, this is synonymous with what I got last night, pedal to the metal on climate change, on childcare. Like, they know they're not going to be another election soon. They ain't going to call it. They're going to go for it. And I'm with you. I don't know what fiscal, quote, guardrails, to use the Vogue term that I've never quite understood, exist. Jason, let me go to your side. What happened last night and what are the consequences?
Well, I usually, Scott and I, as you know, we usually agree. Like, we're usually in, you know, sympatico on everything, like ABBA, you know, the harmonies together. I will say, I think I sort of disagree on the leverage. I think Trudeau, even though he's chastened, and listen, nobody wanted him to lose more than me last night, perhaps maybe Aaron O'Toole and his family, but I think he's chastened for sure. But he has a lot of leverage too. I mean, Mr. Singh doesn't want, you know, he's going to have leverage for sure for negotiation, but we're going to see this phony war of a negotiation between the two. Because the truth is, on policy matters, other than a couple of little, you know, changes, they pretend they're far apart on policy. But if you read their programs and sort of take the brands off the top, there's really not that much to pick between the two of them. So I actually think Mr. Trudeau's got a little bit more leverage than Scott's letting on, because He's going to bring in a throne speech. There's going to be a couple nods to the NDP and the Bloc Québécois, and they're going to have to vote for it. We're not going into another election anytime soon. So I think he's got lots of leverage. In terms of the conservative story, came up a little short, and that's really disappointing. So, you know, you look at this from the big picture, you pull back, we're down 15 points, you know, 6 weeks ago. You claw it back, you win the popular vote. You claw back a little bit in the 905 in terms of vote percentage. It doesn't translate into any seats. And you don't make the gains that you needed to make. And Scott said the NDP got their pocket picked, in sort of Ontario. And I 100% concur with that. I look at it. The NDP tried something different this time in terms of not letting Trudeau, sort of scare people into his corner at the end. That didn't work. Trudeau was able to do it again. I mean, you look at some of those results for the NDP in the 905, they're abysmal. And so when you pull back and you say, what does it take for a conservative win? You got to do well in the 905. The NDP has to do pretty well. You got to win BC. You got to hold what you've got in Quebec and Atlantic Canada. And a couple of those things didn't come true. Some of them, Mr. Singh, some of them Mr. O'Toole. So
yeah,
disappointment for sure.
Yeah. Let's talk about what happens now, because politics is relative. Justin Trudeau's got 31% of the votes. No one's calling an election soon. We've seen that. So the Conservatives are going to, they're not going to pull the trigger. The NDP certainly not, because Jagmeet Singh, for all the kind of TikTok bromancing he's done, he's not translating into much at all. So everyone's going to sit tight, and I think that gives him a lot of leverage. What happens, and maybe I'll start with you, Scott, but I'm intrigued also by Jason. What happens inside the Conservative Party? Because wasn't he criticized for not being, he said the Conservative Party said, okay, Andrew Scheer, you can't win in Ontario. You're too far to the right. You got to get a climate plan. You got to move to the center. Aaron O'Toole does it, and he absolutely gets his butt handed to him. What happens?
Well, I'll give you an outsider perspective. Obviously, I'm the lesser of the learned opinions on this matter in terms of the Conservative Party. But I look at it from this
perspective.
By the way,
you do false modesty so well. Like, I know I actually bought that for a second, didn't you,
false.
Jason?
Underline the word false, right?
Yeah, that was amazing. I actually believe that.
No,
okay,
big
go
bold
ahead.
Letter. Yeah, no, okay. Can I proceed now with blowing Jason off the map? Thank you.
yeah, please do.
I think O'Toole's in a world of trouble, because I think the Conservative Party is in a world of trouble. And it does sound weird to say that. And I'm trying not to be partisan, but I think his own party is riled up. And I think that the relative measure of you started way behind and you came up, the relative measure of doing more or less the same in the seat count as last time, I don't think those things are going to be applied to his leadership. I think he challenged his own party in the middle of this campaign by saying, look, we're not your father's Conservative Party. That to me was a pretty direct message. And who cares what me? Friends of mine who worked for Mr. Harper, a lot of them took it really personally and said he's saying that the recipe for Conservatives is to throw out the Harper years, look past that coalition. I think there's going to be a price to be paid for that internally. And I think if you look at these numbers, there's also big trouble in terms of what's the electoral coalition for Conservatives. They got pumped in 905 and they didn't actually beat... They didn't lose that badly to the Liberals from a popular vote perspective in Ontario. What happened, of course, is that the PPC starts eating away 6-7% in some of those ridings. It serves as a blocking dummy and helps the Liberals run past them. So, and BC, if you told me last night before the vote that the Liberals are going to do as well as they did in BC and the Conservatives are going to do as poorly, I would have thought you were crazy. But so there are big questions. I think O'Toole's in real trouble in terms of his own leadership. And I also think that the Conservative Party has got to do a lot of reflection on what is the right balance, what is the right structure, what's the ideal voter coalition that needs to be assembled.
Okay, let me take a break. I'm going to play what Jenny Byrne said about this, and then I'll come back to you, Jason. Why? Because Scott he did like a Shakespearean monologue, so we'll be back with Jason Lex. They're back. The ABBA of politics, Scott Reed and Jason Leader. They make the melodies of politics, and they're reunited for one last tour. Scott and Jason. Doesn't it just bring chills to you, Scott?
Are we getting any of the ticket sales of this, Scotty? I mean, have you negotiated at all? Because,
I hear the drums of Bell Media.
It's just amazing. when I just think of you two and you both speaking about politics, it's like listening to ABBA. Just beautiful. Speaking of ABBA, here's a little song that former campaign director Jenny Byrne from the Harper years. Here's a little short single that she released last night about Erin O'Toole.
If conservatives do not win this election, it was entirely winnable because we led the polls for at least 2 weeks.
She thinks he's in trouble. Jason, what happens now to Erin O'Toole, who did not live up to his own expectations?
Far be it for me to agree with Scott. It was so long ago what he said. I think I probably just, I'm brainwashed now. But most of what he said was true, by the way, which was there are factions of the party who, for their own interests, want to get rid of O'Toole. There is going to be an accounting for some of the decisions that were made, 100%. And there's our party's been, it's we had a really long run of success there from sort of through 2004 and into 2015. And now we've lost three in a row. We've won the popular vote in two of those three election campaigns, but the fundamentals don't change in that we still came up short in the 905, better, but came up short. And so there are going to be some people who really want O'Toole to go. And that's drumbeat starting already in the conservative, sort of phone lines are burning up, text messages, all that.
Is that right? Like, give us a sense. Just pull back the curtain there. I know in your world, that's normal because that's welcome to politics. When you dine with someone, you take your knife and fork and you stab the other person in the neck after dessert. I get that. But how is that working right now? Like, what are you talking about?
I mean, you know this as well as I do, Evan, but, most of it starts with public relations, basic public relations at the start, right? So I'm sure that the caucus is talking right now. There's caucus members who are, not big allies of Erin. I'm not going to go through names, but I assume that there's some caucus discussion about some of this stuff, and that'll continue. There's, members who will be, far be it for me, anonymous to suggest, but anonymously leaking stories to journalists to sort of put some pressure on. And then that's going to happen. And then on the other side, though, you saw O'Toole's team start to work on the damage control mid to late day yesterday and then through the evening, but with his speech sort of portraying it as, if Trudeau's going to force another election, we're going to be ready, i.e., I've got to be around. Somebody's going to be at the helm here just in case we've got another election coming. So there's going to be there's going to be a real battle.
Does he survive? Let's just call it. Like, can he survive this thing?
Depends if his team is smart enough to set the bar at an achievable number in a party leadership review, and he brings caucus on side. This is the most important thing. A lot of people, sort of mistake the most important thing. If the caucus is leaking against you every day, remember when old Stock Day had to face Chuck Strahl every day and the DRC coming out every day and saying, we're getting rid of this guy. He needs to go. We're not part of his party anymore. All that kind of, you just can't survive that kind of stuff. So Erin's right. First, and by the way, I'm a guy who said on the record, I said last night and this morning on TV, on radio, everywhere, I think he does deserve a second chance. We've got 30, 35, 40 million invested in this guy as part of a training program. And I actually think he's likely to be better the last time. And I thought he was pretty good in this campaign.
Interesting.
And I think it's probably an unwise move. Doesn't mean the political interests that want him to go won't win that battle. But I do think, our party wants to be a serious party, has to think long and hard about, sort of wasting that investment.
Scott Reed, I don't know if you know anything about internecine warfare inside a party. I don't know if that's something that you, working for Mr. Martin in the Kretschmann years, I'm sure you know nothing about that. But, but politically, how does that play? Like, if the conservatives are going through that, basically the dance, political dance version of the Clash song, Should He Stay or Should He Go, what does that do politically for the runway ahead?
oh, well, it's harmful to the conservative brand and it's helpful to everybody else, particularly helpful to a prime minister who, you know, is stuck in another minority and would, you know, would prefer to have room to operate. And, you know, and he's got to figure out, like Trudeau himself has to say, okay, I've had two kicks at this in terms of, you know, trying to assemble a second majority. And twice now I haven't. I need to think about what pieces I need to add to get that job done. And I think now that's going to become, you know, if not a personal ambition and a legacy project, that's something important. And so he would love to have all this trouble with the Conservatives. My advice as somebody, as you say, who's never dipped a toe in these sorts of pools, is the Conservatives need to make a decision relatively rapidly. What really is harmful, particularly in a minority situation, is if you just let this thing sprawl for months and months. Like, if you're going to tear the Band-Aid that is Aaron O'Toole off your arm, then do it sooner rather than later. I'm with Jason. I think caucus matters a lot. I think O'Toole's got problems with caucus. I think the early signs of how they tried to handle it yesterday with, you know, I won't go into like total weeds, but that dreadful leak, or not even a leak, the dreadful comments to the Toronto Star, I thought they were ham-fisted. If they aren't, more skilled than they were yesterday in managing internal affairs, they're going to find themselves burned fast. I think caucus is going
to... Just to remind our listeners, their party chair, Waleed Solomon, basically said to the Star on the record to Alex Boutillier, like, basically, a win for us is just holding him to a minority. It's like, what the hell? You can't keep moving the goalpost. Okay, can we just have one moment where, like we do in sports, the best part of anything is when you're not involved, you get to say, here's what they should have done, you know, the Monday morning quarterback moment. Biggest mistake each side made, real quick, Jason and then Scott. Biggest mistake Trudeau made, biggest mistake O'Toole made, or anyone else, biggest mistake on the campaign that could have changed the outcome?
I'll do one for both. I think Trudeau, if he campaigned more positively, more like 2015 Trudeau, with a I'm going to do childcare, I'm going to do these things, I managed the pandemic pretty well, I actually think he might have done better. I think the first 2 weeks of his campaign were so off message and so off brand and so off tone for him that I think it was confusing to Canadians to watch. So that's number one. In terms of O'Toole, I thought they didn't handle the gun thing well at all. I think they, A, shouldn't have put it in the platform, and B, once it is in the platform and Trudeau's hammering you on it, not that they had to manage it up, but they had to dig in. I mean, Trudeau's, you know, sort of presiding over a gun you know, sort of disaster in Toronto, and I would have dug into it a little bit more and actually tried to fight it to a draw.
Yeah, fight it to a draw. Smart. Scott.
The month prior to the election, Trudeau traveled the country, handed out checks, told people that there was going to be an election, told people he was going to use the power of the public treasury to try to balance that election outcome in his favor. I think it bred cynicism and made the launch of his campaign a real problem. So I would have changed all that. I would have called the election clean earlier. Second, and I know most people say, oh, no, we should have called it later. I say earlier. Second, for O'Toole, and I think this really was his Waterloo. He made a strategic decision for reasons that we won't have time to get into here, but there are understandable reasons, even if I don't agree with them. He made a decision not to demand that all his candidates be vaccinated. That meant that he was gambling that the fourth wave wasn't going to become a pronounced issue. When Jason Kenney had to shut down Alberta, O'Toole's neck was exposed and he was finished.
Well, ABBA had 50 singles. You guys just had two beauties. Scott and Jason, thanks.
Let me be perfectly clear.
Putting out misinformation.
And we hear them.
Misleading politics.
What's really important here.
Spreading it online.
Unequivocally.
The War Room.
Zane Velji from campaign strategist at Northweather, formerly worked with Calgary Mayor Nad Nenshi, Tasha Carradine, principal with Navigator, National Post columnist Tom Mulcair, CTV political analyst, former NDP leader, all of them intravenously taking coffee right now, which is fine, which is totally fine. It's just because as long as you get that thing that rolls along beside you, the coffee just can go right into your vein. I find that's excellent.
Exactly.
It's helpful. Well,
okay. Let's talk. Let's go from Mulcair down the line. What happened? What changes?
Groundhog Day. I mean, it's literally the same result as 2019. Trudeau didn't get the message in 19. The message was, okay, you get to stay prime minister, but you don't get to do everything on your own. You have to work with the other kids. And by the way, you keep breaking your promises, so smarten up. 2021, what might be different? Well, he's going to have no choice but to listen to the message from the people, which is smarten up, start respecting your promises and work with other people. So I think that Trudeau might have had a bit of a lesson in humility last night. Whether it's going to last more than 24 hours is another question.
A lesson in humility. That we call that a haiku in politics. Tasha, what happened and what will change? What are some of the consequences of last night's Groundhog Day?
Groundhog Day, $36 million in 1993, $600 million 25 years later. There you go. There's your haiku for the day.
That's liberal inflation for you there, Tasha.
It's liberal inflation, exactly. Actually, this is the start of my column. So, you know, Tom beat me to the punch. But I did look up these numbers. And I think what surprised me is that it didn't have as much of an impact as everyone thought. This what pandemic anger or anger against the election and the pandemic people thought would drive this. I don't think it's going to drive it forward. I think the results show that the pandemic actually created a sense of a need for security. And that's what you saw play out here. You know, the appeals to the be daring, vote Annamie Paul, you know, think outside the box basically with Jagmeet Singh as well, and, you know, appealing to new generations with TikTok and this and that. People voted for what they kind of knew. The devil they knew, I think. The offering by the conservatives wasn't strong enough to compel people to go there en masse. So this new government has this blueprint laid out for it. I mean, it's going to put in daycare. It's going to continue some pandemic measures. It's going to go on with the carbon tax, and it's going to seek support from the NDP for all of that. So I don't think we're in for a lot of surprises.
Yeah, you know, coaching hockey, Zane, and the kids won a trophy before we played the game. I think that's what Canadians are saying. No one gets rewarded. You got to play first, then we give out the award. See, here's what happens. You want the reward for finishing the pandemic? First, you got to finish the pandemic. Then we give out the awards. Otherwise, get back on the ice. No one gets anything. And keep your heads down and play your asses off. That's the message Canadians gave everyone. But what do you think the consequences? Because I think, though it's the same result, I think the consequences of this for a lot of political careers and maybe for what we're going to see are big.
I agree. I think there's a bit of humbling to Tom's point. There's a bit of hobbling, though, as well for Justin Trudeau. He does not get to land the plane on his legacy with a four-year majority. You expect him to perhaps have, I wouldn't say the knives out, but, you know, trying to think of a succession plan that is less, optimized for a four-year cycle, more so for finding the successor and trying to leave on his own terms the best he can versus in the most idealistic way he can. You also have an extension of Groundhog Day. Let's forget, you know, this election night looked like 2019. Let's also talk about what happened right after the election, which is the knives out in the conservative circles for their leader. That extension of Groundhog Day we very well might see again. I think it's going to be a more interesting textured conversation because the lane that O'Toole picked this time, but the sequel to Groundhog Day, which although it sounds incredibly meta, is perhaps still happening as we enter the next couple of weeks.
Well, Tom knows that because, I'll go to you, Tash, because in conservative Groundhog Day, they eat the groundhog.
Well, I was going to say, is it Groundhog Stew Day? The key here, the conservatives are going to have to decide what they, if anything, they need to change. Is it the message or the messenger? Because the appeal to go to the center didn't resonate, but was it because of the person delivering it, or was it because there were other options, like the PPC for people who are really far to the right, or were there other reasons? So it's a lot
of soul
searching.
And that
way it's like 2019 again.
For O'Toole one way or the other. Because he stood there last night and delivered essentially, speaking of Groundhog Day, the same line that Andrew Scheer delivered back in 2019. Scheer, sensing that he was going to be really a target, said, now it's time to circle the wagons because we're going to have an election in 18 months. And the answer from Corey Dunaik and others was, oh, yeah, that's right. So we're just going to throw you out. And so O'Toole stood there last night and said, Trudeau talked about an election in 18 to 24 months. Oof, no time to throw the leader out, eh? And the answer is, we're going to think about that because it depends on what Conservative Party wants to show up for the next election. With an iron fist and a heck of a lot of political acumen, a very tough-minded Stephen Harper held the Reform Party and the Progressive Conservatives together. He had Peter McKay there sitting in the front row, always gave him the best jobs that he could, said, this is the guy from the Progressive Conservatives. He's part of my team. He held that thing together. Yeah. It was an unwieldy beast, but he did it.
Yeah.
Now, two people, Scheer and O'Toole, have tried to do it in their own way. Scheer tilted more towards the right of the party. O'Toole tried to tilt a little bit more to the progressive side of the party. both failed. So there's going to be a question out there. Does that magic person exist, or is this party bound to start falling apart again, much to the glee of Trudeau's Liberals?
Let me just play. Here's Aaron O'Toole, and I was thinking about Ted Lasso, the Emmy Award-winning comedy, because Ted Lasso, the coach, the hapless coach of the soccer team, always likes to say, what's the happiest animal in the world? The goldfish, because they have a short memory, so that's why they can live in a fish. And Aaron O'Toole's like basically delivered his Be a Goldfish speech. Here it is.
In the months ahead, as Mr. Trudeau gears up for yet another election, we must continue this journey to welcoming more Canadians to take another look at our party. More people voted for Canada's Conservatives than any other party, and that's a strength to build on.
There is. Be a goldfish. Forget about the last 36 days. Yeah. Let's continue on. Does that work, Tash?
Well, it's okay. Here's the thing with goldfish. They grow to the size of the bowl, right? And the bowl here, the electorate, the base isn't growing. They have to grow the base, but how? The only real pool, if you want to tap into the GTA in particular, you've got to make an appeal to new Canadians. You've got to reach out to people that are not traditional, quotes unquote, stereotypical conservative voters, you know, thinking of people in more rural areas and whatnot. The growth is in the cities. They have to find a way to do that. They have not found a way to do that. That is the key. And I don't know who the person is to do that or what the magic formula is, but unless they do that, unless they make conservatism appealing to new Canadians, the party will become a more regional rump party over time.
I like that. Grow the bowl.
Grow the bowl.
Zane.
And to quote another Ted Lasso moment, Aaron O'Toole thought this was just practice. This was just practice for the next round. He was just here to...
That's Allen Iverson, just so you know.
Yeah, oh, it practice. Is. It is Allen Iverson channeled by just, Ted Lasso.
Okay, okay. It's good. I got it.
I like it. I like that you're a fan of the show, Evan. Here's the thing.
That's a great show.
Here's the thing. He's going to try to say that I pulled off the right strategy. I may have been aggressive on the timing, but there is markers in us gaining the popular vote. Does that sound like sure? Yes, it does. There are markers in us perhaps growing in areas that we had potential in. Did we get the seats? No. And if I can do my job of bringing the tent that's left us to the right and bringing everyone into that same circle, we can get this thing done. We have the right strategy. We have the right message. I may have been too aggressive on the timeline. I think that could be his saving grace. And if I am a conservative, easy for me to chirp from the sidelines, I would look strongly at that to say that, you know, we have to be relevant to a growing base of Canadians more and more with table stakes policies like O'Toole has presented. So I think their biggest mistake will be throwing out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak. And, you know, we'll see what happens. But I think one tip for Aaron O'Toole next time is you got to start celebrating. Celebrate like your Jagmeet Singh, who came in fourth place two elections in a row, because that really, I feel like, is the modern Canadian narrative of just being like, oh, I won. OK, who cares what the numbers say?
Hold on. We're going to come back. Well, Zane trolls Tom Mulcair. We're going to give it back to Tom on the way. My God, that was just unbelievable. We'll be back.
Making sense of the latest news. You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
We are back inside the post-election war room where nothing's changed, but everything is different. Zane Velji, Tasha Carrot, and Tom Mulcair are back. When we last left off the episode of The War Room, Zane Velji was gently trolling Tom Mulcair about the new math that the NDP had. The new math being Jagmeet Singh's math curriculum, where you can keep losing seats and yet float upwards and give yourself an A. In the math of Jagmeet Singh of 2019, you can lose 20 seats and dance a victory. And then in 2021, on your second crack, you can win between 1 and 3 seats, depending on the mail-in ballot, and you can be beloved and keep on that record and declare victory. And that leads us to Tom Mulcair, who has the new math of the NDP versus the old math of the Conservatives, who win seats and lose leaders.
Yeah, but they didn't. The Conservatives didn't win seats where they had to. If Mr. O'Toole was going to pull it off, bringing his party kicking and screaming towards the middle of the road, he had to prove that he could win in the Greater Toronto Area, and he lost. It just didn't work. With regard to Mr. Singh, he bled off support the same way Broadbent did, the same way I did. And he bled off support in the dying days of the campaign to the Liberals. I think Mr. Trudeau set the record, it should be in a drinking game, every time he said the word progressive. We want a progressive government. Progressives have to work. You know, he didn't come right out and say, don't split the vote, but it meant don't split the vote. And it worked because Singh went from 25, 26, you know, in most polls in the greater Toronto area and the core part, especially downtown Toronto. He went down to like 18, the same way it was across Canada, and 10 in Quebec.
So but you said that. Remember, you said on this program, can he hold his vote? Does a strategic vote?
It's always
and the truth is, and they delaminated him.
Oh, yeah. And the Liberals are brilliant at it because what, you know, what they're doing is essentially saying, yes, we bought a pipeline. We do have the worst record in the world on climate change, or at least in the G7. And of course, we tore up the report on democratic reform because it wouldn't help the Liberals. But you have no choice but to vote for us because we're the lesser of two evils. And look at those horrible conservatives. So it works. You know?
I am so there for you doing these voices, Tom. I never knew how bad I needed you doing this stuff until you started.
This is the sotto voce, you know, soap opera voice that he loves using, and it just drives me up the wall. But getting back to Mr. Singh, I think he's absolutely firmly in the saddle right now. The party is going to love him, especially since in the last days of the campaign, he's clearly started auditioning for the role of conscience of parliament. Now, it used to be that the term conscience of parliament drove NDPers up the wall because it was a talking down to you term used by Liberals saying, oh, you've got such good ideas in the NDP, but you're just Liberals in a hurry. And we used to go nuts saying, no, these are actually things that should be done and not just talked about, which is what you do. So Mr. Singh is now going to get to sit down with Prime Minister Trudeau and hammer out a deal because Trudeau has just said he's gone on record saying he doesn't want an election anytime soon. Fine. Mm. I mean, he's got a best before.
But they're
date
not.
Right
but
now,
they're
and
not.
He's got an albatross.
They're not just conscience, though, Tom. And I'll throw it over to Zane. They're kingmakers now, and a kingmaker is a conscience with power.
Kingmakers with more leverage than perhaps they had in the last parliament. I don't know, Tom, if you wanted to jump in there, but
don't forget that on any given vote, the Bloc or the Conservatives could still back them, which is what happened for 2 years. But here, you're going to get a chance to actually sit down and hammer out a deal. And what you put into that deal and what you can actually have them deliver, which are two different things, that'll determine what Mr. Singh is able to convince his party about in the next campaign or convince Canadians about, because Pierre Trudeau wrote the book on this. He made that sort of sweetheart deal with David Lewis, then turned around and ate him in the next campaign and got his majority back. So this might take Justin a little bit longer, but it's the same game plan.
And they're kingmakers in an era where the only clear mandate that the Liberals have gotten is go do your jobs. So if they can be the accelerant and the lubricant to ensuring the Liberals do their jobs, that's where the leverage comes from, because they have to act in haste.
And the thing is, too, I mean, you look at the agenda that the Liberals have got out there, the NDP were already taking credit for all of it, and now they can continue to do so. It's exactly right. There's no point being a conscience in a majority government, because you're just sitting there in the corner complaining. But if you have a minority, you really do have that power. And then you can say, well, look, they did this, they did that, we agreed to it, or we did not, and that's why it happened. So, you know, that's why Singh is doing his victory dance, because he's maintained that balance of power. Had he lost a number of seats, or had the Liberals got a majority, then he'd be in trouble.
Yeah, but and the Liberals also know that there is now a bit of an albatross around Mr. Trudeau's neck, and it's going to start to stink into the party, because this boneheaded idea of calling this general election in the middle of the fourth wave of the pandemic, it's not going to go away. The bad idea that it was is not going to become a good idea now that they've copied and pasted the results of the last election. I was doing a radio show this morning in Toronto, and I had a senior Liberal advisor on, and he was being pushed a little bit. You know, what's the future for Mr. Trudeau? And the answer was, oh, he can stay as long as he wants, you know, if he chooses to stay. And I wrote down if he chooses to stay, and I threw it back and I said, that's not exactly what you call a ringing endorsement, you know, if he chooses to stay. Mm-hmm. So he had to chuckle over that. But I think that that's where they are right now in the Liberal Party. They know that there's a horizon for Mr. Trudeau. Is it 18 months? Is it 2.5 years? But it's something like that. He's got to give the new person, whether it's Chrystia Freeland or Mr. Champagne or who knows, Mark Carney, who eventually comes in and takes over from Mr. Trudeau.
Here it is, the Carney rumors already.
Okay, I want to get to Jason Kenney's future in a minute with Zane, but real quick on from you, Tasha. Max Bernier loses, People's Party get like almost 800,000 votes. Are they a pandemic blip that burn out, or are they here to stay?
Well, I hope so, because I think the energy they channeled around the pandemic is very detrimental. But it really depends on the pandemic. As long as this goes on, there will be people, the vaccination issue will be there. It'll be live. It'll be turned into the anti-government issue. That those folks may also not vote. That's the thing. They may not. It's not that they may drift back to other parties like the Tories. They maybe won't go to the polls if that issue disappears. So the party will shrink as a result. The thing is, though, based on the current status, he would have a role in the debates next time. Mr. Bernier, you know, got more than 4%. So if those are the criteria, he's not going to go away, and that message won't go away.
You want to bet that there's no consortium debate next time?
Well, yeah. that's true, Tom. I'm a little tired today, but you're right. Maybe that's a silver lining. There won't, you know.
How about this?
We're great.
If I go through the rest of my life without hearing the word consortium, I'd be delighted. It's just the word is so ugly.
I nominate you, Evan, for hosting the debate next time. There you go.
Well, thank you. Even the word cabal is better. Okay. I'll just throw that out there.
That's probably more accurate.
I'll just throw that out there for the trolls. Zane, what's going on with Jason Kenney? Can you tell the country and why it matters?
Yeah, there's almost a consortium of public opinion in Alberta, Evan, where the anger is palpable. We've just heard moments ago that Jason Kenney's making a big cabinet change today. It may not be big in volume, but what we're hearing is that it's going to try to swap out at least the health minister, from what we suspect. This is totally on brand for Kenny.
Tyler Shandro? Oh, my God. Is this deck chairs on the Sky Palace?
It could be, because let's go back to Jason Kenny's MO. Let's look at his MO. Doing very little to placate a small group of people, uproar, and then doing the right thing or the necessary thing thereon after. That has been the pattern for the last 18 months, especially in and around COVID and all the political decisions related to it. This is the first phase, that little exercise that will create an uproar tonight and tomorrow. The mutiny is on, especially not just from the caucus, which has been ongoing for the last several months, but now from the federal side. I've been talking to operatives, conservative operatives here in Alberta and across the country. The knives are out for Kenny in any way possible to ensure he is out, because a lot they feel for the O'Toole loss is to blame to the hands of his former cabinet colleague, Jason Kenney.
That, by the way, that deck chairs on the Sky Palace reference was a very Alberta one, because of the famed Sky Palace, the penthouse suite that in Alberta is toxic, where Jason Kenney had the white tablecloth dinner.
And the bottle of single malt on the table.
Yeah,
Irish whiskey that was
no beer.
Apparently
economical
the Irish whiskey
or budget
was
whiskey.
Budget whiskey, which was Jameson's. I like that stuff.
That was not Jameson's.
It was. He said it was.
See, that's what he said.
I can spot Jameson's across the country.
Across the country?
Yeah. My description of the new government in Ottawa is same Titanic, a few new chairs.
Yes. Okay. That's it.
It's like, is everyone just trying out their lines? Is this just batting practice? What is this?
This is fine. Although I will say this about Justin Trudeau, and I know we got to go, and we'll do this every week. I can't say, but the guy keeps winning. Like, whatever. People don't like
that's
him,
true.
But. You know, he hasn't sunk yet, so we'll find out. All right, Tash, Zane, Tom, you're the best. We've got to take a break.
From coast to coast to coast, the newsmakers talk here. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Politicians talk. Dave Lavery does. Politicians make promises. Dave Lavery gets results. He's a founding member of the JTF2, Canada's special forces, essentially. And I've known a bunch of the guys in there quite well. These are the best of the best. They are quiet. They are not looking for glory. And they are out there to complete a mission and save lives and get the job done. And if you know a guy named Canadian Dave, you're about to meet him. He has been quietly working in the midst of the collapse of Afghanistan, the 20-year war, the longest war in American history, over. People stranded. And you know how people got out? They got out because some people gave a damn and risked their lives. And one of them was David. And he joins us now. He's known as the Canadian Dave. 100 people he got out in the final days. Thank you, sir, for your service. David Lavery, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Evan. It's very humbling.
Well, I've known your story for a while. I've worked behind the scenes to try to get the story out, and it helps get some people out or support the people doing it. A lot of veterans at the Veterans Transition Network and others who are doing incredible work to do it. But you were on the ground, and I want Canadians to know your story. And so before we get to Kabul, I just want people to know your service to the country. How long were you in serving in not only in the Canadian Armed Forces, but in JTF2?
It's surprising even JTF2 is brought up. I'm not even mentioning anything on that. I'm proud to say that I did belong to the unit, but I would just leave it at that. At this stage, I've served for the military 23 years. I retired as a non-commissioned officer, and I ventured into my own business, and I ended up in the United Nations as one of the senior security advisors for about 10 years, and my first 5 years was actually in Afghanistan from 01 to 05. And while I was in there, yes, a lot of our military guys and gals, they were in town, in country, as I was with the UN. But I had a lovely time in the military. I have total respect for everybody that serves, still serving, and I am just honored to be in the presence of a lot of folks that are doing business, both militaries, you know, the Canadian militaries, the U.S., the Brits, everybody, and more so the British paras that really were a phenomenal bunch of folks during this whole event.
Let's walk us through. Your story is incredible. You know this country well. You've been there. You have contacts everywhere. Walk us through when you knew the Taliban were about to win, and not just there's going to be a long road, but they're coming to Kabul where you were.
Well, I mean, I think it's to walk us through that. I mean, a lot of us were taken, you know, caught off guard. Let's just be very honest there. We knew the inevitable was coming, that we were all preparing it. We were all looking at our contingency plans. We had that in place, but because we've taken on more projects, more people were demanding more assistance because of the concern that the Taliban were coming to town, it sort of put us in a different position. We were concentrating on others instead of concentrating on ourselves. So the actual timelines and everything, they became very, very rapid, to be honest. You know, a few months back, you know, we knew it was coming, but everybody figured we still had, you know, months and months and months, not weeks and then days and then hours. And it started to really change rapidly when the north fell, you know, especially Mazar City, and then they were starting to get closer. And when they were getting that close, it was, okay, that's all right. Kabul is going to be still safe. There's a lot of security. Taliban's not going to come on in. They're still going to honor. So there was that misconception also. I think there was a lot of window dressing going on for the last year and a half or whatever, and there was a big facade. And to be honest, I think the Taliban played a decent role in deceiving and moving and at lightning speed and taking over things, telling everybody.
August 15th, you know, they take over. You're the only Canadian left. Like the I remember the government evacuates the embassy, the diplomats fly out. And I'll tell you, folks, there are thousands of Canadians and thousands of interpreters who want to get out. And you know how many Canadians were left at the ground on Hamid Karzai Airport in the midst of that chaos? And I'd love you to describe it. One, and it was you, Canadian Dave. What was it like? Can you just describe what you were seeing?
Well, I mean, the first bit, again, you have to realize we went into evacuation mode, Evan. We had to leave our property, our team, after we sanitized everything and cleaned things up and destroyed and burned, and packed up and moved to the Barren. That was our contingency plan all along. We were going to move into the Barren and stay in that location. One, it's close to the airport. You can get in through the back area. It's secure. They had decent security on that place. And it was a good logistical hub. At the same time, I had my son with me, my wife with me, and one of my staff members. So you have a lot of things running through you, and then you have an obligation to all your clients. So I had three priorities: my team, my family, my clients, and then our Canadian project that we are looking after and still are with the Canadian Afghan applicants that also need a place and need to get out. So when we got up into the Barron area and we were starting to adjust into our new environment, things started to happen rapidly fast. I mean, very fast. And by the next morning, when we woke up, the British forces, the paratroopers, they were taking over. They were controlling that whole battle space, that whole area, which was a good thing for us, because within hours, the streets were flooding. And as you saw on the TV, you saw thousands of people rushing the airport, hanging off planes, getting onto the aprons. It was the noise. It was the buzz. There was continuous gunfire going on all the time. You just didn't know who was doing what. There was a lot of folks in town saying they were Taliban, but they weren't Taliban. There was just criminal elements. You know, it was desperate times, and people were doing desperate things. It was all about survival, and it was weird. It was different than even a movie that you watch. You know, the zombie movies and all these things where people are acting and just jumping off buildings and buses and cars and stuff, and then.
It was like that though. Like you're saying, it was just that. It was that chaotic for people to get to the airport.
Yeah.
God, Dave, it was crazy.
Yeah. So once the dust settles a little bit and people start realizing they've got to get to the airport after a couple of days, that's when we started to kick in. When I say we, myself, yeah, I'm on the ground by myself. But when I say we have an army of phenomenal people sitting back home all across Canada, all our veterans, the Veterans Transition Network. You've got Amalara. You've got ACI with Wendy leading that. You've got a whole bunch of retired senior officers, generals, media crew, just doing a phenomenal job. And this for us, and that's a different story for us, you know, it didn't start on the 15th. You know, this is going back years of preparation and then back to June, setting up, you know, safe locations, et cetera, to help out all of those, you know, over 1,300 applicants or whatever it is. Once people started screaming towards the Barron and that gate to try to get on a freedom bird to get out of country, that's when the chaos really started to happen. And then once people started making it in and there was sort of a process going on, then people were getting trapped in, you know, just trapped in the volume of people. To go 800 meters, it might have taken them 12 hours to 24 hours. And then you had kids, you had pregnant women, and you were getting suffocated, you were getting trampled. Jeez.
And then
people were passing out. They were throwing babies over the wire. That kids were passed to us. I had to pass them on to my wife. You know, the British soldiers, if it wasn't for the British para, we would have had chaos. They were phenomenal.
Dave Lever, just stay with me. We're going to keep you for another blog. This is the most important story, and I'm going to tell you something. I was following you because I was on a series of calls that you were on from Kabul, but we'll talk about that. This story of how the lives were actually saved from the man on the ground, okay, continues next.
When important decisions are made, we report. Here's Evan Solomon.
At one point during the crisis in Kabul, a bunch of journalists and a lot of veterans, you know them, veterans like General Dave Fraser, who's a regular on this program, General Thompson, who's been on this program many times, Kevin Newman, great journalist, Lisa LaFlamme, a bunch of people who are very interested in this situation. We got on a call. There was a morning briefing. And on the call was the guy known as Canadian Dave, Dave Lavery. And he was in Kabul. He was with his family and he was rescuing people. And it was chaos. And it was after August 15th. The Taliban had taken over. The Canadians were leaving. And people were surrounding the Hamid Karzai International Airport and trying to get out. And former Special Forces soldier, works with the UN, has his own security company in Kabul. Dave Lavery was just going to stay, not get out, and he's going to help people, and he joins us now. Your service and your story, I know you're modest, and I know you're used to it because that's what you've been doing for decades, but it's remarkable. Tell us how you were getting people out. You got more than 100 people out, and apparently everyone was looking for the Canadian Dave. It was bureaucratic chaos. There was danger. The Taliban were shooting. People were literally lining up in a sewage pit, a sewage drain, basically, outside the Hamid Karzai airport. How were you getting people from their homes inside the wire onto planes?
Well, that was a good one. I mean, there's a lot, like I said at the beginning, there's a lot of desperate things happening. Desperate people will do desperate things. And we would advise folks if they could move, if they could get to the Baron, the front gate, or the northeastern gate, or the back gate, to do so the best way they could. You know, we would tell people to dress light, good shoes, put a backpack, fill it full of water. You know, keep small things close to you. Your family, stay united, and you would have to push your way to the front. And once you get there, pull out a red scarf or put on a red hat or something like that and use the code word Canada or Canadian Dave, or get on your phone. For those that were in contact with somebody would contact me, take a picture. I would have an idea which area to look in. And the beauty behind this is, as I said before, at the very beginning, there wasn't very many people in the area except for the British and myself, and they were really, for the longest time, they were wondering, who is this crazy dude running around back and forth doing a marathon every day trying to grab folks? I wasn't just Canadians. A lot of my clients are German clients, so I had an obligation to over 300 of them, and then obviously all of our Canadian applicants, and for that matter, anybody who had, you know, a passport, and they waved it at us, and if we could do something to pull them in, we'd pull them in.
But the Taliban, like, just so like people triage. Know, like Dave, the Taliban are out the wire, and getting them from their house through the wire, you're essentially running the gauntlet. These people are not wanted by, I mean, they're wanted by the Taliban. These are wanted mm-hmm. people. Taliban does, these are people who work with the West against the Taliban. So you're literally, I guess you and all those folks are in mortal danger all the time.
Well, I mean, I wasn't in the front danger line, I would say. I was out there, you know, your meters away on the other side of the barbed wire from the Taliban. So the Taliban, they were controlling it. But also, they were overwhelmed, too, with thousands of people rushing to the entry point. And it was a choke point. You know, it's a roadway. And then before you know it, it's trying to be controlled by the Taliban. And then makeshift barriers being put up. And the British soldiers were doing riot control. And then, obviously, I would, you know, get to know a lot of them. And I said, hey, listen, if anybody comes in and they're yelling out Canadian Dave or Canada or, you know, whatever, and they were waving red, just let me know and I'll come on in. And it was perfect. I mean, you would be getting calls. Where's Canadian Dave? Where's Dave? You know, we got some Canadians. We got some Germans. Wow. So to get people to that point, you know, you can't imagine what it was like when you had staff members and you had folks that you knew and you were telling to run the gauntlet. It wasn't the greatest feeling, I can tell you that. It was something that I've never experienced before. You know, the noise, the smell, the scenery, you just can't get that stuff out. And then when you said, you know, people standing in the swamp, the sewage area, we call it the swamp. It was surreal because no matter what time of day it was, there was always that hum and buzzing and people yelling and asking and pleading, help me. I've got a passport. Oh, I work for the Canadians. I work for the Germans. Take my kids, whatever it was.
But Dave, so, you have your own kids there. I just want people to know your wife and family are there. And on August 6, 26, a suicide bomber blows himself up at the gate in the swamp, at the gates to where a lot of these people are, killing U.S. Marines, as you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's literally, what, an hour? Your wife and kids were evacuated like they were just not far from that, were they?
Yeah, so back up. My son, so everybody thinks I have little kids. My son is 36. My son is 36. He got out on a Canadian plane. He was lucky. I know the Canadians, you know, they offered to come and pick up myself and my family complete and, you know, doing a great job, but sort of put me in a predicament. Also, that night when the Canadians arrived, they gave us a call. Dave, we're on our way to pick you up. They showed up and I saw, this is awesome, because I told my son and my family, I said, don't worry, the Canadians will be coming. You're going to be well looked after. So I said, yep, Brent, you're going to head off. And I said, my wife will accompany my son. I'm staying behind. I can't leave. I've got a duty to do back here with my clients. And I have a lot going on with our veterans and our team back in Canada. We have a big picture. We have a big plan. And we're working well. And we will continue to work well. So just take my son and my wife. And they looked at my wife. Passport, we're just she's Chinese but has a Canadian visa in it, and we're married. Mm. And they said, unfortunately, we can't take your wife. And I'm going, excuse me? And they said, no, the only way your wife's going to get on that plane is if you come on with her. And I said, well, I can't do that. Well, then she can't come on the plane. So Evan, it sort of put me in an awkward spot, and it shouldn't have never happened, but it did. So a long story short, I ended up going with them to the airfield where the Canadians were processing, extremely upset, you know, hummed and hawed, really upset. And I asked them again if they would just take my son and my wife. They said, nope, your son can go. Your wife can't go unless you go. And I said, okay. So a couple hours later, I basically called up my German clients. And I said, here's the deal. And they said, well, you can't leave. We need you to help out with the rest of the stuff that you're doing. Yeah, you know, I'd had everybody lined up. I had everybody outside the gates ready to come on in. And so they said, I said, basically, all I need is two seats on your German planes and I'll stay behind and I'll have no problems. So they called back to Germany and they woke up some deputy minister late at night, right, and told them the story. And it was no issues. They said,
okay,
yep,
Dave, hang on just for time. I want to have you back on. My listeners across the country want to hear this. Someone just asked me, did you leave anybody behind? Of course they did. There are hundreds and thousands of people. But let me tell you, Dave Lavery, Canadian Dave, former Special Forces soldier, is not going to stop. He's still working. There's operations going on. I want to assure our listeners, he is working every moment, and his team and many soldiers, many veterans, many groups of people are working to still get people out. This operation is far from over. I want to assure people. And if you wouldn't mind, Dave, I would love to continue our conversation and keep following the story so the media doesn't forget it. And if we'll call you anytime, because I really, one thing the media does, they forget about these things. We won't. Please come back on. And you have an open invitation here any day of the week, sir. Thank you for your service and thank you.
Thank you, Evan. Much appreciated. I'd love to come on back on.
And you will.